play a little Stevie. Step, play the music, play the music, then you'll know. That major, tune into what your mama played ya. Time to celebrate, time to create before it's too late. Oh, go to your favorite place. Speakers pumping, pumping that bass. So dance, what do they play? Daddy, all up in your face.
Hello everyone, welcome to the now, I believe, seventh installment of Swing Politics. It's going to be a big one today. Wasn't here to do my show 2 weeks ago, but pretty excited to have a lot on deck for the listeners today. Anyone who's up on this rather chilly morning here in Medford, Massachusetts. This is Big Mitch with Swing Politics, and you're listening to 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. Walked here, it was 45 degrees, and not something that I expected at the end of April. So, hoping that doesn't stick around, but the weather app at least is telling me that that is not going to change anytime soon. But right now we're focusing on politics, because, while it might not be good to a lot of people, it's interesting to some. So that's enough to distract me from the chills this morning. So what are we going to do? Where are we going to get started? I think it's something that I haven't discussed quite yet, because I wasn't here 2 weeks ago, was the Wisconsin State Supreme Court election, which went to the Liberals. Which went to Kelly Pertesiewicz over Daniel Kelly. So I think it's important to discuss sort of this election and why it's so important. I know that I had discussed it in weeks prior, but I think it's good to reemphasize that what this means is that the Wisconsin State Supreme Court is now controlled by liberals with a 4-3 majority. And just to give the sort of some insight into how extreme the conservatives were, it was a 4-3 ruling in 2020 to certify the election results, to not reject the electors in for the 2020 election for Joe Biden. 4-3, which means if there was one more conservative on that court, or if the one conservative that voted with the liberals decided to side with the other conservatives, that Wisconsin's electors wouldn't have been certified or wouldn't have been accepted. So that's pretty unacceptable as a democracy, and the voters have corrected that. The voters saw, and I went into great detail of how Protasiewicz was flooding the ad market just with absolutely, you know, crazy amounts of money for a state Supreme Court race. But it's also necessary because now Democrats, liberals control the state Supreme Court, and that's important for any ruling. And it allows to do what the Republicans love to do now with the U.S. Supreme Court, which is run everything up to the state Supreme Court. So anything that does not have federal jurisdiction that is specifically to Wisconsin, just run that up to the state Supreme Court because they'll side with you. You know, politics is not a game of morality. As much as everyone wants it to be about morals, it's about winning. And in this case, liberals, Democrats won this race. So they should be quick to use it, to use this power. Protasiewicz doesn't take her spot on the court until August. There's like a 4-month waiting period, which is a little bit long and a little shocking. Especially the reason why this is so important is because Wisconsin, for the entirety of the 2010s, was really not a democracy. And what I mean that is that gerrymandering in Wisconsin is very easy for Republicans to do. Democrats are very concentrated in two specifically urban areas. That's Madison and Milwaukee. Madison is sort of the big juggernaut for Democratic success in the state. And so it's really easy to pack Democrats into the same districts in Wisconsin. And that's what Republicans did in the 2010 redistricting cycle with Scott Walker and Robin Voss. And Robin Voss is basically like, he's known as, quote unquote, the shadow governor of Wisconsin, because all Tony Evers can do, who's the sitting governor, who's a Democrat, who was just reelected in this past November by over 3%, which was a big win for a Wisconsin Democrat. The only thing he can do is a veto pen. That he can just veto the legislation that the state legislature passes. And Robin Voss is the Speaker of the House, the State House, and he'll just keep bringing things to Evers' desk that he'll continue to reject. And the State Senate Majority Leader has a supermajority in the State Senate. Even though the state is 50-50, the Assembly is about 63 seats out of 99 for the Republicans, and the State Senate is 22 out of 33 seats for the Republicans. And Biden won the state by 0.6 in 2020. Evers won it by 3. Doesn't matter. Protasiewicz won the state by about 11 points. She won by 11 points, and she did not get a majority. She got a majority of state Senate districts, but she did not get a majority of Assembly districts. She got like 48 out of 99. So that tells you how unhealthy Wisconsin's democracy is. And that's clear because Republicans have held super majorities or very, very strong majorities for the entirety of the decade of 2010s. And now there is advocacy group that advocates for nonpartisan judicial maps or basically anti-gerrymandering that has put a case on the docket for the state Supreme Court to hear basically the day that Protasiewicz takes up her position as justice of Wisconsin's Supreme Court. So currently, this is focusing on congressional maps, this case, and obviously Wisconsin is gerrymandered at the congressional level too. There are eight districts. It was sort of meant to be a 5-3 pack in which Republicans always would win 5 districts and Democrats would always win 3 districts. This was a gerrymander done in 2011. And in 2011, the constituencies of the Republican and the Democratic Party were very, very different. So there was one district that is now controlled by Republicans that was very solidly Democratic up until this past election, up until really 2020. 2022, it was flipped by the Republican. This is an area. It's sort of like the border along Minnesota in the southeast, in the southwest corridor of Wisconsin, and it kind of follows those border counties between Wisconsin and Minnesota, and this is what's known as the Driftless area. I don't know why it gets that name specifically, but this is sort of a notorious area for being what used to be very strongly Democratic sort of rural voters that continues to leech support and go to the Republican side. And this is the case also with the congressional district just south in Illinois, which was won by a Democrat because due to Illinois' Democratic gerrymandering, which allowed Democrats to win 14 of the 17 districts in the state, which I actually approve of because it's healthy for democracy in some ways. And I know it's contradictory to be assailing Republicans for gerrymandering while also praising Democrats for doing it. But again, this is a game of politics. It's about winning. It's not about morality. And I think that's something that everyone has to remember. There's a good and there's a bad. And sometimes not every action that you're going to take is going to be perfectly in line with what you want society to be like. Because would you rather have control of the House or disarm when you have the power to give yourself the power in the House? Because Republicans are going to do it either way. So you better get in shape. You better be doing everything you can to make sure that that you have that majority. But why is this Driftless area important? Effectively, it created a congressional map in which Democrats sort of assumed that they would always hold that Driftless seat in the southwest portion of Wisconsin. Republicans would hold the other five, and then the other two districts were packs of Milwaukee and the Madison area. So there was no way that Democrats or Republicans were competitive in any of them. But the Driftless area has gone to the Republicans, and the Republicans now flipped this seat, making it a 6-2 Republican state in representatives in the House when it's still a 50-50 state. And so this will probably be redrawn by the state Supreme Court to make it a more even 4-4 or to have a few more competitive seats, something like that. That's sort of one of the biggest impacts of Protasiewicz winning, is that Wisconsin's maps can be ungerrymandered at the congressional level and then also the state level. Democrats might have a shot at taking back the state House and state Senate for the first time since Obama's election in 2008. That's a big deal. It's a very big deal. That was a huge win. Huge, huge win. It wasn't unexpected, but it was a blowout. It was, 11 points. And again, I referenced the fact that Protasiewicz was flooding the airwaves. She had so much money, and Daniel Kelly, who is a 2021 insurrectionist type, election denial candidate, extremely right wing. He wasn't really raising any money on his own, and it was PACs, super PACs that were putting the money in for the campaign. And the reason why this is inefficient for the Republicans and for the conservatives is because specifically PAC money gets about a third of the rate of what regular campaign money does. So if you're a candidate and you raise money on your own, each of those dollars to pay for an advertisement is fully put to use. But when a PAC has to pay for the same amount of advertising time, they have to pay three times the amount because their money only gets one third of the impact that a candidate's own dollars do. So super PACs are extremely inefficient when booking advertising space. So although Daniel Kelly and Protasiewicz were able to raise almost the same amount of money, into advertising, on Kelly's side, it was a third of the impact of Protasiewicz's, and that was a big reason why she won. There was also sort of a lesser known district that was a Trump plus five state Senate district, and that would determine whether or not Republicans would maintain supermajority control in the state Senate. Republicans ended up winning the seat by under 1 point. This is a Trump plus five district. It was a really, really bad night for Republicans, and they did keep their state Senate supermajority, And there was discussion that they were going to try to immediately impeach Judge Protasiewicz, soon to be Justice Protasiewicz. And that idea was quickly thrown sort of out by the state Senate majority leader. And I think that's something that's respectable, because there's only so much you can do to piss off voters. And impeaching the justice they just elected, that's a pretty bad one. So, yeah. There was also the Chicago election, which was a little bit less because it has less partisan implications. It was sort of less on the radar, at least I'm not a Chicago resident. But Brandon Johnson, who was the more progressive of the two candidates by a pretty decent margin, won. He won by about 3 points. Paul Vallis was a former Republican who was running as sort of the more conservative, crime is all over the place type of option. Like, we have Eric Adams in New York City, who is horrible for the Democratic Party. I'm very, very upset with the messaging that he does, which is just the Democratic Party is so bad at crime and crime is out of control. And he's part of the reason why Democrats did so bad in New York in 2022. So, you know, being a mayor is always a thankless job. But hopefully we'll see Brandon Johnson run for something in the future. He's a very good candidate. And he hasn't quite taken the office yet, but he'll have, I'm sure, very low approval ratings, because no mayor of Chicago has good approval ratings in this age. So there was also the reporting of the Clarence Thomas ProPublica sort of discovery with regard to gifts that he had received from friends to go to lake houses, to go water skiing, stuff like that. Basically, the report is that Clarence Thomas has quote-unquote friends in places that happen to be a bit unsavory for someone who is a Supreme Court justice, and that these people are right-wingers. And that a lot of the disclosures that he has sort of left out are slowly being uncovered. But, you know, it's just corruption. It's just plain corruption in the highest court. And Mitch McConnell's reaction to this was that he will let the Chief Justice, you know, deal with how the Supreme Court is handled. Which is rich coming from McConnell. But I also like the fact that they, you know, Roberts will handle it, knowing full well that Roberts is a complete pushover, does not care, is happy to just say, oh, what you did wasn't great. Not great for the optics of the court, which she used to care about so much until the hyper-conservatives held a five-person majority, and now Roberts' vote doesn't matter at all. So, but a lot of my show last time was on Roberts and the Supreme Court. I will say that the Mifepristone ruling, that was a 7-2 ruling to keep the abortion pill access that's been around for 30, 40 years, that ruling was definitely the right ruling. It's crazy that the two most conservative justices are Bush nominees. They're not Bush appointees. They're not Trump appointees. And I think that's sort of a testament to the more hyperpolarization, in that even the Supreme Court nominees are looking at public opinion. So right now on the court, you have three divisions of people. You have the three liberals. You have Alito and Thomas, who are just insane. They're just so right-wing, they don't care. They'll take the country back to the 1950s, 1920s. They don't really care. They hold the majority. They say, why not use it? And then there's the four conservative justices who actually care somewhat about public opinion. And they care about how elections will sort of impact everything. And that's obviously Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Barrett, and Roberts. It's interesting that you know, they're very worried now. It's not really about morals or ideals or what they believe in terms of their ideology, their conservative ideology. It's more about how can we do enough conservative without pissing off everyone, because Dobbs did that. The Mifepristone ruling was a good ruling. It's the stay, I believe. I think they're going to hear the case at some point. But it's interesting. It's interesting how they're learning. And they're learning not to be liberal. They're learning to be pragmatic in their conservative. I've never heard of pragmatic conservatism at this moment, and that's something that just came to mind. I wonder how that will continue to play out in their next few years and in their lifetime on the court. Because Alito and Thomas basically say, we have the power, we have the final say, Congress will not do anything about it, because it's true. Even if Democrats fully controlled Congress, they wouldn't be able to do anything about these rulings. Because they wouldn't have supermajorities, because no one will have a supermajority. Especially in the Senate. And speaking of supermajorities, Senate majorities, be a good time to transition into some Senate talk. Senate talk is always, it's always good, always interesting. So in Montana, there is a very heated race for John Tester's seat. John Tester is the Democrat. Is one of the two incumbent senators, along with Steve Daines, who is a Republican. John Tester is a Democrat. He was elected in 2006, and he's been reelected in each of his elections, 2012 and 2018. He's always won with very slim majorities, 4 points, 3 points, and the like. So yeah, he has a very tough road ahead of him, especially in a presidential year when crossover voting is uncommon. He requires support from independents, from Native Americans, and not only support but turnout from loyal Democrats, from Republicans who are concerned about their own party, and they like John Tester. John Tester is widely approved of. Out of all of the Democrats in the Out of the three Democrats in the most threatened states, West Virginia, Ohio, and Montana, Tester's for sure seated the best of those three. You'd think that it would be Sherrod Brown, but in Ohio, but he doesn't really overperform. Sherrod Brown's a good candidate. He's a good Ohio senator if it was 10 years ago in Ohio, but it's not 10 years ago anymore. And rural voters, and the working class counties that have been the bastion of Democratic strength in Ohio, especially Mahoning County, are gone. Ohio is gone for Democrats. So I expect to see Brown lose in 2024, which is a shame because he's a great senator. But at least for right now, the focus is on John Tester. And so Tester's won with very small majority, with small, not even majorities, with slight pluralities even. In 2006 and 2012, both of his wins were pluralities. He won with under 50%, but above 49%. In 2018, he won with 50.3%, which was his first majority win ever. And sort of how did he win with a plurality? I mean, people know that there's a few people running in a race, and that's going to impact who wins, but it's not a primary. There's not, you know, a whole bunch of people running for the same party's nomination. In this case, what it was is the Libertarian candidate that would siphon off votes from the Republican. So the Republican would get up to 47, 48%, but the Libertarian would also get 2 or 3%. And so Tester was able to win with 49%. Even in 2018, 50.3% is not a commanding majority. It's definitely a majority, but it's very slight. And if you assign those libertarian votes to the Republican, then it becomes a 0.6% race, which Tester still does win, but it's much closer than the 3-4% win that he won by. It was 3.5% in 2018. There was an article in 538 regarding sort of how the libertarians' votes would be allocated and how Tester would sort of lose, would benefit or lose from a new law that Montana Republicans are supporting only for the 2024 Senate election in Montana. In no other election, the presidential election, any of the House elections, in any of the state legislature, any of the statewide like governor's elections, this doesn't apply. But specifically for the 2024 Senate election, there is a bill that that promotes that only allows for the top two to get votes. It'd be like an instant runoff type of thing, where the top two vote getters will instantly have votes assigned to them from the other votes, from the other candidates. So the Libertarian candidate, if they got 4% or 3% in the election, those voters would then have to decide automatically who they want their next choice to be. It's very logistically complicated. And it's runoff voting. It's what we have in New York City and stuff like that. Or it might be ranked choice. I don't think they ended up deciding. But there's a bill for edits to be made to the 2024 election and how that's progressed. And the 538 article looked at what percentage of the Libertarian voters would Tester have needed in each of his in 2006, 2012, and 2018 to win. And it proved that it wasn't a heavy lift for him. He would need less than half of those Libertarian voters to get over the finish line in his 2006 and 2012 election, and in his 2018 election, he would have already won. Now, I don't know logistically why it's been sort of pushed off, but the Republican Party did table the bill in Montana. The state legislature tabled the bill. And it's definitely a good thing for Tester, for sure. I think if you have Libertarian candidates that are reassigning their votes to Republicans, he's less likely to win. But his approvals remain very high. They're the highest of any red state Democrat. He's known as someone who can work across the aisle, someone who is a Democrat for sure, but it's about like his vibes. They like his vibes. And I think that vibes are important. I think that John Fetterman, he was a lot of his candidacy, like, yes, his policies were good. People liked him, but he could relate. He could relate to the voters as a Pennsylvanian. He had vibes that were Pennsylvanian vibes, and he was running against a horrible opponent. He was running against Dr. Oz, who was an out-of-stater elitist. But and we'll be getting into Pennsylvania in just a minute for 2024. But that's what I think John Tester can learn, actually, from Fetterman, even though Fetterman is just, this is his first term. So for now, that bill is tabled. And we'll see if it is picked up again soon, because that will impact Tester's re-election odds. So I mentioned Pennsylvania, I mentioned Fetterman, and we have a Senate race again in Pennsylvania in 2024. This is with Bob Casey's seat. Bob Casey was elected first in 2006, along with John Tester for his freshman class. He kicked out Rick Santorum, one of the worst, most awful Republicans in the Senate at the time. And still now, Rick Santorum is just awful. But Bob Casey started out his tenure as a pro-life candidate. He was not for abortion. I think he still has some sort of misgivings on the stance of abortion, but he understands that it should be within the choice of the woman. And if he doesn't, you know, support them, it's sort of irrelevant in that his voting pattern is very much one of a pro-choice candidate and is one of a pro-choice senator. So who is he going to be running against? Republicans completely fumbled the ball in the last election. with Oz. And who is the candidate that they're going to put forward? So there's two main candidates that have emerged from this election, from this sort of, from the shadow primary, as we call it, which is the primary before the primary, trying to see who's getting into the race, who will not join because other people have joined, who will try to convince others not to join. It's like I discussed for Michigan's open Senate race, how Alyssa Slotkin, who's the representative from Michigan's 7th district, or sorry, 6th district, edged out everyone else and said, you know, I'm going to be running for this, and had her allies make sure that no one else competitive was going to be running for this seat. And so there's two main candidates that have emerged. One of them is Dave McCormick. The name is definitely relevant for Pennsylvanians because he was running in the 2022 Senate primary against Dr. Oz and Kathy Barnett. Dave McCormick is a businessman. He's a multimillionaire. He doesn't have any ties politically. I believe he is an out-of-stater. I don't believe his home is Pennsylvania originally. I don't know if it is. I mean, obviously it is now, but I don't know to what degree compared to Dr. Oz, who basically didn't live there. And he's like an elitist type of guy. But he lost to Oz in the primary by about under 1,000 votes. I believe it was like 900 votes. He's definitely, and he of the candidates from 2022 is the most moderate. Relatively most moderate, meaning he's still right wing, but maybe not as insane as Dr. Oz or Kathy Barnett. He is definitely a relatively stronger candidate in a general election than Oz was, or than other candidates might be. But he's also, you know, he's an elitist, and I don't know how Pennsylvanians will see that. And he'll be running against the best candidate that Democrats could ever hope for, which is Doug Mastriano. Doug Mastriano ran for the governorship of Pennsylvania in 2022. Against Josh Shapiro, and he lost by like 15 points in Pennsylvania, which Biden won by 1.2%. Mastriano is an anti-Semite. He is an election denier. He is an insurrectionist. He's a former state senator from Pennsylvania. Mastriano is someone that, if he does get the nomination, I am not worried, and that seat is entirely safe for Bob Casey. But something interesting happened that Politico reported on recently, that Trump has stated, or was in talks with Mastriano, and said that he will not endorse Mastriano in the primary election because he fears that it would hurt him in Pennsylvania. That, weirdly enough, I mean, this is definitely true to some degree, but by putting Mastriano on the ticket just below him, that it would actually hurt his chances of winning the state, which is definitely true. It's sort of like trickle-up voting instead of trickle-down voting, where the person at the top of the ticket ruins it for the people at the bottom. And it's definitely true that I think that there is some water to that statement. Maybe it's not as impactful as the presidential election impacting the Senate election, but it's extremely likely that if Mastriano is the Republican nominee for the Senate race, that it will hurt other people on the ticket, including Trump. You might get this balancing effect where people might vote for Trump a little bit less than they were planning on it, but because Trump voters are turned out, they might vote for Mastriano more than people were expecting it. But Mastriano won the primary with about 40%. It was a split primary amongst about five candidates, and he won with 40% for the Republican gubernatorial nomination in 2022. So this leaves us This leaves us probably likely with Dave McCormick. Dave McCormick is not a very strong candidate for the Republicans. And I think it's interesting because Republicans are turning to self-funders for this upcoming Senate cycle. If you look at West Virginia, and if you look at Montana, West Virginia we'll be getting into in a second, these three candidates that are leading, so McCormick, Jim Justice, who is the sitting governor and also a multimillionaire, and Tim Sheehy, who is a businessman that is likely to run against John Tester in Montana, all three of them are multimillionaires, and they're businessmen or former businessmen. It's weird. It's a weird strategy, because is it something that Republicans can't raise money? Republicans can't raise money on their own, so they're going to have people take out money from their own pockets, which is a really, really interesting thing to have Republicans have money on their own because they can't raise it because they're too much of an extremist party. I think that's a very, very strange approach. The Republican Party in its heyday of, I guess, 2014 to 2016 type of thing, in the modern era, they were the populist party type of thing. They were fiscally conservative, but they were also Trumpian and enthralling as candidates. And that's not these people. These people, Sheehy and McCormick and Justice, are, maybe not Justice, but the other two are milquetoast businessmen. But in West Virginia, there's a report that Jim Justice will be launching his campaign against Joe Manchin this week, I believe. And this is sort of a big middle finger to Joe Manchin, because Manchin was the one that convinced Justice to run for governor in 2016 as a Democrat. And Justice won as a Democrat in 2016 in West Virginia for governor. About like 3 points. He won with like 48% of the vote. But that's crazy. It's absolutely crazy that the person that convinced him to run and pushed him to run is the person that Justice is running against. Now, personally, Joe Manchin is not going to win against any candidate whatsoever in any realm. You could run someone as right-wing as Mussolini or Hitler in West Virginia, and they would win if they have the Republican name, if they have that R next to their name. So, personally, I would prefer to have someone like Jim Justice be a Republican senator from West Virginia compared to a crazy right-winger, you know, election denialist like Alex Mooney, who is the representative that's also probably going to be running for this seat. Instead, you have Jim Justice, who is a very sensible Republican. He's very pro-vax. He is pro some gun regulations. He is pro-welfare. He's a very common-sense Republican. And he was just reelected very overwhelmingly. Obviously, he's a Republican and an incumbent in West Virginia. But Joe Manchin is not going to win either way. So the replacement cost of someone like Alex Mooney versus someone like Jim Justice, you can't compare the two. For the Democrats, at least, Jim Justice is going to be someone like a Susan Collins, like a Lisa Murkowski. And I, frankly, would prefer, if there's a Republican Senate majority, I would prefer to have a Jim Justice there than an Alex Mooney. Sure, would I prefer Joe Manchin? Yeah, but that's not going to happen. Joe Manchin is not going to suddenly, out of nowhere, overperform the ticket, overperform Biden by 40 points. It's not going to happen. Manchin won by 3 points in his 2018 re-election campaign. While he is a good candidate and West Virginians like him, I mean, you compare in 2018, Claire McCaskill in Missouri, who was also two terms, Joe Donnelly in Indiana, and Nelson in in Florida. These are candidates that have been there that were not first termers, or they were running for re-election in a very blue year, and they still lost. But Manchin in an R plus 40 state was able to win re-election. So it's definitely a testament to his prowess as a Democratic candidate. But 2018, when you had a lot of rural reversion to the Democrats during the Trump era, West Virginia was one of the places where you saw the most Republicans swing back to vote for Democrats in 2018. Doesn't compare to when you have 6 years later, a presidential year that you're running at the same time. Right below Joe Biden's name is going to be Joe Manchin's name for Senate. It's going to go Trump, Biden, then you have Manchin versus whatever Republican is the nominee. And Manchin will not win. But Jim Justice agrees with Manchin on a few things, agrees with Democrats on a few things, is very moderate for a Republican, especially coming from West Virginia. And I have personally no problem him being in the Senate. I like him. I would prefer a Democrat, you know, obviously, in any given instance, but that's not going to happen. It's interesting because you want to have people, you know, my ideology is have the more extreme Republican run in swing states, competitive states, because it makes Democrats' odds of winning go up. But in this case, that's not the case, because Joe Manchin's odds of winning are 0%, regardless of who the Republican nominee is. I think Manchin will retire if Justice decides to run, which he will. And I believe Manchin will just step back. So that's my guess. What else is going on in the Senate? You have Dianne Feinstein holding up the entirety of the Democratic agenda. Dianne Feinstein is the senior senator from California who has dementia and now shingles. And she is not in the Senate. She's on the Judiciary Committee. And Judiciary Committee, you need unanimous consent to continue with nominees. And she has completely held up all judicial nominees. All of them. So the Democratic majority, the goal of keeping the Senate in 2022, the fact that they did that doesn't matter, because Schumer put her on the Judiciary Committee because of seniority. And it takes 60 votes to remove her. And she's not resigning. So Democrats can no longer confirm judges. Unless Schumer wants to change the rules, which he won't do for some reason. When it was Harry Reid was saying, let's change the rules, doesn't matter, it is our agenda that matters most. Schumer says, I care more about the rules. And McConnell says, that's great, good for you, you should care about the institution because I certainly don't. So Dianne Feinstein is single, and Chuck Schumer, the two of them are single-handedly holding up the entire Democratic agenda right now, which is judges. And you'd think that after 4 years of Trump and them holding the state and holding the Supreme Court in a 6-3 majority, that people would actually care about that at this point. But no. They'll just sit there on their hands. That's the Democratic Party that I know, which is devastating, because they finally had their stuff together for a little bit. I don't know what the path with Dianne Feinstein is moving forward. Unless she resigns, Republicans refuse to replace her because it helps them. Because then they keep those judicial vacancies. Those are now open for Republicans to fill in 2024. And Democrats lose the Senate. So thank you, Dianne Feinstein, who has dementia and has continued to have dementia. And I don't fault her for having dementia. I fault Chuck Schumer for keeping her on a very, very important committee. I mean, Dianne Feinstein should know that she should have retired. I mean, she's basically being propped up by her staffers at this point, and she's not even there. It's really, really devastating after all the work that was put in during the midterms. And something better change soon. Because Durbin and Schumer, Durbin is the head of the Judiciary Committee, and Schumer being complete pushovers at the moment. Durbin didn't even subpoena Justice Thomas to discuss the ProPublica and the ethics report, because he said it wouldn't matter because Thomas wouldn't respond to the subpoena. Which is crazy, because what else are you doing right now? You're not passing any bills. You're not passing any judicial nominations. So you're not even sending out the subpoena. That's like sort of, that's just due diligence. It's so upsetting. Speaking of Senate and congressional matters, the debt ceiling showdown is going to be a mess. It's going to be an absolute mess. McCarthy and the Republicans would prefer to see the government shut down. McCarthy and the Republicans, what I believe will happen is that there will be no deal on the debt ceiling extension, because their demands are insane. They're asking to cut things like Pell Grants. But this is all behind closed doors. No one knows about this. They're asking to cut welfare programs. They're asking to cut a lot of things. So if Democrats cave into those demands, then it's blamed on Democrats that they don't, that the people don't get the economic benefits and welfare things that they deserve when funding the government. And if they don't sign on and they say tough luck, then they shut down the government under Biden. The economy goes into a free fall, and then Republicans win in 2024. When Democrats held a trifecta, they had the chance to avoid this, and they decided against it. Unfortunately, that's the Democratic Party, I know. The debt ceiling fight will not be resolved. The government will be shut down. Which is a shame. After all that Biden's done, that's what people are going to remember him for. When the government was shut down under Trump, they had a Republican trifecta, yes. His approval rating went to 37%. It wasn't during an election cycle, and that's why no one cared. But when the economy tanks because of it, because the economy in that case didn't tank because it was strong. The economy now is very touch and go. It's strong in some ways. The inflation is still really bad, though it's coming down. And the idea that the government will just be completely shut down, that everything will just stop, it's going to be devastating for the Democratic Party. And there's no way that Democrats can win, which is a shame, because recently Democrats have been very good at figuring out ways of winning at the congressional level. This way they can't. I think what they have to do, in my opinion, is to sign on to the McCarthy bill. Because that's the only way they can. Keeping the government afloat is more important than the cuts to things, because Republicans hold all the cards. They hold all the cards. You're not going to figure out a way to go over McCarthy's head. The only way you can do that is getting five moderates on the Republican caucus to sign on with the Democrats for a discharge petition to force a vote to the floor to raise the limits at the levels that Senate Democrats and the House Democrats and Biden sign on to. And you won't find five moderates, because there aren't. There aren't five moderates. You have Brian Fitzpatrick, who's one moderate. You've got... That's about it. You have maybe one moderate. Most of them... Of the moderates that you can think of in swing districts, like Don Bacon, like Kevin... Kevin Duart, like... David Valadao, like Mike Garcia, or no, Mike Garcia isn't a moderate. Mike Lawler from New York, Desposito from New York 4. These are people that are moderates, or they pose as moderates for the Republican Party, but they're not. And they wouldn't sign on to that, what the Democrats support, to keep the government afloat. Because they prefer it if the government gets shut down. When the government gets shut down, it's better for their election odds. So, on a little bit of a lighter note, because that's a very upsetting topic, I will say that there's some good news out of New York. New York Democrats are actually doing the work that they need to for the first time in a year, thanks to our lovely governor, Kathy Hochul, who has, for some reason, seen the light, because she just put up a conservative justice for the New York Court of Appeals, and it's mustered and used her all of her political capital on it, and the state legislature did their job in rejecting that nomination, because and they killed it. I mean, he would have enshrined. Currently, there's a 4-3 conservative majority on the state Supreme Court somehow, and in New York. But Hochul just nominated two people to fill some of the roles, moving one of them to Chief Justice. That's Rowan Wilson. He was an associate justice, and then nominating Caitlin Halligan, who is who's a liberal, but she's a little bit has a little bit of a conservative streak, but she's still a liberal. And the New York Senate Democrats were not worried about her nomination at all, and they were both confirmed. So for the first time in decades, New York has a liberal state Supreme Court, also known as Court of Appeals, but it's functionally the same thing. For the first time ever in recent history. That's a big deal, and the reason why is because Senate Democrats were burned, state legislature and congressional Democrats in New York were burned by the Court of Appeals, because the Court of Appeals struck down their gerrymander. And Democrats want to gerrymander again. And they're going to likely have a little bit less of an ambitious gerrymander compared to the one that they had in the first redistricting cycle. But in this cycle, before the 2024 election, it seems like there's a lot of motivation for a redraw of this map that was drawn by a Republican, helping Democrats take back the House in 2024. And it's also in response to North Carolina planning on gerrymandering their map now that they hold the state Supreme Court, which is currently a fair 7-7. They're going to gerrymander it to an 11-3. 11 Republicans to 3 Democrats in North Carolina. So New York Dems are thinking, why not do the same thing? Which is appropriate, as they should do. And I think that I'm happy that the New York Democrats, and I truly praise the state legislature. I praise Stuart Cousins, the state Senate majority leader, for orchestrating this, for making sure that that the former nominee couldn't get on that court, and that these two who are pro the Democratic Party, that they're for the Democratic Party, are in power, and will be in power, and they are. And they will rule on these cases, hopefully, in a way that the state legislature Democrats look favorably upon, as do national Democrats, because it should take everything in our strength to take back the House in 2024. And that doesn't mean rolling over when you hold the power, because Republicans sure don't roll over when they hold the power. So it's time for my biweekly PSA, which is very important. One moment. Doorknobs, restrooms, telephones, keyboards, other people. What do these things have in common? They are all easy ways for you to pick up or pass along germs. Germs that could lead to colds and flu. Now you can't spend your days avoiding contact with everything, but you can take a few important steps to protect yourself. Washing your hands is one of the best, easiest ways to avoid catching or spreading colds and the flu. Keeping your hands and the surfaces you touch clean protects not only you, it protects those around you. A few extra minutes a day is all it takes to put your health first. For more on avoiding the flu, talk to your doctor or visit massmed.org and click Your Health First. This public message brought to you by the Massachusetts Medical Society. I hope you enjoyed that PSA. Everyone should wash their hands. I don't do it enough. And I don't like getting sick. Not fun. I'll make one last point. I think that I've said it a lot, and I've said that, politics is a game of, winning. It's not a game of morals. Policy is the game of morals. And while you need politics in order to achieve policy, there is no way to achieve policy without politics. As confusing as that may sound. So, this has been Big Mitch. Mitch Saunders. With Swing Politics. 91.5 FM, WMFO, Medford, Tufts, Freeform Radio. It's been a pleasure. I hope that I'll be back in 2 weeks. We'll see if it works out with my timing. Keep paying attention to those election results. The election results that do happen that maybe you don't know about. Keep paying attention to what's going on in politics. Because it's fun to read about. It's fun to look at. It's fun to understand what's going on. It's not really fun when there's, you know, real implications and there's danger and bad legislation is being passed, but it also makes you aware of what you're fighting for and what you're fighting against. I'll be sure that whenever I'm back on air, I'll keep everyone updated as best I can on politics, on what's important and what's important in the election world. I hope that someone's enjoying some warm weather today, because I know I won't be. All right. Have a good one, everyone. Thanks for listening.